Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, I want to thank you for being here with us. It is not easy out there right now. Much of the news is really tough and a lot of uncertainty around us. But one thing that is certain is the world. We're going to keep bringing you critical reporting on international events, keep highlighting the voices and people at the center of these stories. And we're able to keep doing this because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 30th, we're in fundraising mode. We need to raise $25,000 before the end of the month. If you believe, as we do, in independent, fact-based journalism and in its power to make sense out of the noise and help preserve democracy around the globe, I hope you'll support our work financially. Please make your gift today at theworld.org/give or check out the link in the episode notes. Every gift helps us get closer to our goal. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show. Fighting in Ukraine has put a national resource in jeopardy, a seed bank, a safeguard for the genetic material of hundreds of Ukrainian crops.
Unfortunately, only a tiny proportion of the seed samples in Ukrainian gene banks are duplicated in other places.
Also today, traffic, trains and jackhammers. Parts of Europe are so noisy that it's shortening people's lives.
The basic thing is that noise creates a stress response. And little by little, this contributes also to changes in metabolism and cardiovascular diseases.
I'm Marco Werman, and in parts of Africa, French culture and language still dominate.
They even teach you that you should be happy you are learning the language of the white man.
Increasingly, though, young Africans in places like Senegal are saying enough. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it here this Friday. 100 days, that's how long Ukraine has been fighting the Russian military. Neighborhoods reduced to rubble, hospitals, schools, and railways destroyed. And then there's the displacement of people and the deaths. It's difficult to accurately count the human toll. President Volodymyr Zelensky said yesterday that at least tens of thousands of Ukrainians have died, adding that up to 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying each day. It's even harder to estimate the toll on Russian troops. The World's Daniel Hoffman begins our coverage today, taking us back to the start of the conflict.
For months, Russian military forces deployed along the border with Ukraine. But the Kremlin insisted that an invasion was not imminent. Then, in the early hours of February 24th, it began. As the Russian military bombed Ukrainian cities, towns, and villages, President Vladimir Putin appeared on state television. Putin said Russia is conducting a, quote, special military operation in Ukraine. This is how Russian officials have consistently referred to the conflict. In Russia, even using the word war could lead to prosecution and imprisonment. Putin said that the goal of this operation was to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. According to Russian state propaganda, the country is controlled by Nazis and needs to be liberated through regime change. Putin went on to warn any nation that would dare to intervene in Ukraine. Russia's response will be immediate, he said, and it would lead, quote, to such consequences that you have never encountered in your history. President Biden addressed the American people later that day.
The Russian military has begun a brutal assault on the people of Ukraine. Without provocation, without justification, without necessity, this is a premeditated attack.
Biden made one thing clear. The U.S. would not be putting boots on the ground in Ukraine. However, he said the U.S. would give direct military support to Ukraine. The Kremlin seemed to believe that this would be a quick victory, that Russian troops would prevail over Ukraine's in about a week and even be welcomed by local population. But that's not what happened. Although Russia has seized a significant amount of territory, so far Ukraine's military has repelled Russia's main assault. And Ukrainians have rallied behind the leadership of their president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
President тут. Всі ми тут. Наші військові тут. Громадяни.
Зеленський stayed in Kyiv, even as Russian forces reached the outskirts of the capital. In this video, Zelensky says, the president is here. We're all here. Our troops are here. Our citizens are here, protecting our independence. In the last 3 months, Zelensky has proven to be a skillful communicator.
Russia is trying to defeat the freedom of all people in Europe, of all the people in the world. It tries to show that only crude and cruel force matters.
Ukrainians have felt the brunt of that force, suffering on many levels.
The United Nations Migration Agency says the number of people displaced within Ukraine has risen again, reaching 7.7 million.
Another 7 million people have left the country altogether. Most of the fighting has shifted to eastern Ukraine. When Russian forces retreated from the suburbs of Kyiv, the world learned about the atrocities they carried out.
Images from the town of Bucha near the capital show at least 20 civilians lying dead in the streets. They show people, apparently civilians, murdered execution style. Some had their hands tied behind their backs.
The effort to document war crimes in Ukraine is underway. The U.S. and many other nations have responded by sending military and humanitarian aid. But Ukraine's government says that it needs more firepower to win this war. Last night, President Zelensky had this to say. The longer the war goes on, he said, the more Russia will be known in history for its vile, shameful, and cynical actions. The fighting rages on in parts of Ukraine. The U.S. is sending more sophisticated weaponry. But 100 days on, it's hard to see how or when this war will end. For the World, I'm Daniel Offman.
The World is based in Boston, so you better believe I tuned into the NBA Finals last night to watch the Boston Celtics versus the Golden State Warriors.
The Celtics take Game 1 of the 2022 NBA Finals.
The Celtics pulled off an epic fourth quarter comeback, a very entertaining night if you're a basketball fan. But before tip-off, we were reminded that there's something bigger than the game. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Viewers tuning into ABC last night were first hit with this emotional appeal.
105 days. It's been 105 days since Brittany Griner has been wrongfully detained in Russia.
This is NBA star Carmelo Anthony talking about his friend, Brittany Griner.
She is a WNBA player, an Olympian, a teammate, a sister, a daughter, a wife. She is a human, and she needs to come home.
Griner was detained more than 3 months ago. She was accused of having hashish oil in her luggage at an airport near Moscow, an offense that could carry a 10-year prison sentence. At first, Griner's friends, family, and teammates weren't really speaking out. They didn't want to make her situation worse by antagonizing Russia. But now they're making some noise. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver told reporters yesterday that the NBA is pushing for Griner's release.
We are working in lockstep with the U.S. government and outside experts on trying to expedite her release in any way we can.
Last month, the Biden administration reclassified Griner as being wrongfully detained, which means they're not just going to wait for Griner's case to play out in Russian court. They're going to actively negotiate for her release. This seems to have been what Griner's friends and family had been waiting for to kick their public pressure campaign into high gear, a campaign aimed at Russia, but also at President Biden. Griner's wife, Sherelle Griner, went on Good Morning America on Wednesday and spoke with host Robin Roberts.
I know that you want to speak with President Biden.
Absolutely. I just keep hearing that he has the power. She's a political pawn. So if they're holding her because they want you to do something, then I want you to do it.
Roberts followed up and said U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reached out and said Britney's release was a top priority. She then asked Sherelle Griner, do you believe him?
I don't know. I was grateful for the call. You say she's top priority, but I want to see it. And I feel like to see it would be me seeing BG on U.S. soil.
Sherelle Griner said that her only contact with her wife has been through letters. As for the basketball star languishing in a Russian jail, Brittany Griner is still waiting for her day in court. That's been pushed back again and again. It's now been 106 days Brittany Griner has been behind bars and counting. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We all know the perils of pollution, whether it's in the air or water, but there's another kind of pollution that doesn't get as much attention, noise. Researchers say sustained loud noise can cause stress. It can actually shorten your life. In Europe, the World Health Organization says excess noise contributes to some 16,000 deaths each year. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, one of Europe's loudest cities, on efforts to lower a volume that's turned up to 11.
There's sound, and then there's noise. Big difference. This is sound. Mosquitoes. Totally annoying. Or, where I live, wild boar. They squeal in the woods at night. Unnerving, but these sounds won't make you sick, because they stop. This is constant. In Barcelona, loud cars clog the roads. This is what researcher Sasha Komenko calls noise.
Okay, so we're standing outside with Sasha. My hopefully reliable sound meter here says 65 to 80, jumping back and forth. Does that sound about right for this kind of traffic?
It makes sense because we're in a busy road, so yeah.
And ironically, they're calling this kind of sound the silent killer. Why is that?
Yeah, because I think we don't perceive that it acts on our health. But once you study those things, then you pay more attention to it.
So you can't unhear it.
Yeah, exactly. You know it's there.
Komenko studies noise at the Barcelona Institute for Global Health. Her team has compiled noise data from nearly 700 cities in Europe.
Because we found that around 60 million adults in European cities are exposed to noise that's harmful for health. We base ourselves on the recommendations of the World Health Organization, and they recommend that noise pollution from cars does not exceed 53 decibels over 24 hours.
53 decibels. Barcelona's traffic leaves that in the dust. Like Komenko says, once you start paying attention to noxious noise, you notice it everywhere. Like this construction site, 90 decibels. Or our endless stream of tourists, 65 dBs. Even skateboarders by the Modern Art Museum, bad for you. They hit a cool, consistent 75 decibels. That's without mentioning the trains below and the planes overhead. Conclusion, urban dwellers are under acoustic siege. Professor Maria Forrester studies how it can make us sick.
The basic thing is that noise creates a stress response.
Forrester is also at Barcelona's Global Health Institute. She contributes to the WHO's research on how noise erodes our body's defenses, especially when you don't notice it. She says white noise, over time, can harden our arteries or cause hypertension.
And little by little, this contributes also to changes in metabolism and cardiovascular diseases.
To demonstrate how we can get dangerously used to noise, Forrester suggests a quick experiment.
So we're on the fifth floor of this office building in downtown Barcelona. So now we're going to shut the windows. You can hear yourself think again.
It changes quite a lot, right? Yes.
But shutting windows isn't a real long-term solution. Here's one idea, this super block. It's downtown, but you can hear birds singing. Decibel level, just 42. Super blocks are tree-lined streets and intersections revamped for pedestrians. Planters and park benches are everywhere. 82-year-old Ana Lopez sits on one of them, her cane and grocery bag next to her.
Para el peatón estupendo, sinceramente. Porque tenemos donde descansar un poquito.
For pedestrians, this is great, she says, because now we have a place to rest, and you can walk around without stress. The city has plans for more superblocks, also to possibly tax cars entering the city from elsewhere. This summer, the mayor's installing experimental sound traps, like radar for noise, to ID vehicles exceeding noise limits, like delivery trucks or motorcycles. In the meantime, though, the noise drones on, often well above those 53 decibels where health concerns start. Which attracts people to what might just be the quietest place in town, a meditation center called Silenci, or Silence Barcelona. Tonight, a relaxing yoga session.
Se han pasado unas 8,000 personas más o menos por el centro.
Some 8,000 people have come through our doors in the last few years, says owner Susana Lopez. We try to be an oasis within the city. The folks who come in, she says, suffer from anxiety, stress, insomnia. Lopez encourages people to find inner silence to deal with the outside cacophony. In the meantime, though, you can always try earplugs. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Reports from Ukraine this week say a seed bank storing the genetic code for thousands of crops is potentially at risk of being destroyed. The seed bank is in heavily bombed Kharkiv, and a nearby research facility is reported to have been damaged last month. Stefan Schmitz joins us from Bonn, Germany, to tell us more. He's the executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. Stefan, what can you tell us about what's happened to the seed bank in Kharkiv?
Yeah, despite recent media reports, our current understanding from the management of the gene banks is that the main seed collections of the gene bank are still safe, and that the damage we are seeing online on a YouTube video, for example, is mainly to an agricultural research station. Unfortunately, some working seed collections at this experimental stations were destroyed. It fortunately is partially duplicated in other places.
So the one we're talking about in Kharkiv, is that seed bank or the research station an actual target? Are they actual targets for the Russian military, to your knowledge, or are they simply at risk because they're in a war zone?
They are simply at risk. We do not have information that they are specifically targeted.
So before we move on, Stefan, there are a number of seed banks around the world. What is a seed bank and why are they important?
Well, a seed bank is a big freezer or a cool house where you store, where you conserve seeds of many different crops. And I mean, it's kind of a life insurance for mankind. Gene banks or seed banks provide a safe and cheap means to secure crop diversity.
I mean, the war in Ukraine, any war is totally unpredictable. What would be the implications if this particular seed bank in Ukraine were lost?
That would be really a loss, because we have to see that some of the seeds that are collected there are unique. You cannot find them in other seed banks around the world. Unfortunately, only a tiny proportion of the seed samples they have in Ukrainian gene banks are duplicated in other places.
Even with the duplication, though, I mean, we have to recognize that Ukraine is a major exporter of wheat and other grains. So how would that industry be impacted if the seed bank were damaged?
This would not impact the current production. The current production of crops, of grains, is completely independent from what is in the gene banks. However, once the seeds in the gene banks are lost, they are lost for future developments of new varieties. Varieties then be able to cope with changing climates, with new pests and diseases. And that's a tragedy behind it.
It sounds like there are contingencies to back up possible destruction of Ukraine's seed bank. Is there any way to protect the seed bank from being destroyed? I mean, what are your main concerns?
Well, the main concerns is that they can be destroyed in a war. Even if it's not been intentionally destroyed, it can be a collateral. Things can happen in a war. And there is little we at the moment can do from outside. We stay in contact with partners and management of the gene bank in Ukraine. We work urgently on a coordinated, swift and concrete support. We all do our best to identify the best ways to support the gene bank in Ukraine and protect them.
Stefan Schmitz is the executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, speaking with us about what's at risk with Ukraine's seed bank that is in a war zone. He joined us from Bonn, Germany. Stefan, thank you very much for your insight.
Thank you very much.
The phrase, laughter is the best medicine, gets thrown around a lot. But one woman in the UK has actually put that into action. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
And welcome to the stage, the wonderful Angie Belcher.
Angie Belcher has been a stand-up comedian for 12 years.
Hello, I'm your sexy middle act. How you doing, Beth? All right?
Belcher makes a lot of jokes about parenting a toddler and growing up with an emotionally repressed parent herself. She says her master's degree in psychology is a help, and that therapy and comedy actually have a lot in common. They both require quite a bit of soul-searching.
In order to know who you are on the stage, you need to know who you are off the stage.
Belcher is now combining her two passions and teaching people to work through their trauma with stand-up comedy. Earlier this year, doctors prescribed her six-week course to 12 participants.
We go into performance technique, how to get ideas, lots of drama games, how we put emotion into our scripts, and then because it's stand-up comedy, about making it sound like you've just had the idea.
Class members then learned how to use those tools to share their story and perhaps feel less alone.
The tiniest little thing that happened to you that was like really tough, or the biggest thing that has happened to you, has probably happened to someone else. And that's where comedy creates connections with people as well as making people laugh. For me, comedy is a political act.
Will Reynolds was one of Belcher's students. He says he did feel closely connected with the other participants.
Because you end up kind of knowing really deep, meaningful things about each other. And that's amazing.
Reynolds says he's previously tried group therapy, medication, and counseling, but nothing helped much. He's always used humor as a coping mechanism, and then heard about Belcher's course.
And it was the best thing that I've ever done.
Reynolds has actually done stand-up before, so he knew how to tell a joke, but not like this.
The thing that was amazing for me was tapping into actual real emotion and finding the kind of funny thing in there and being able to talk about stuff on stage in a real way is amazing. Like, there is humor in trauma because that's how you get through it.
Pain is often at the center of a good comedy routine. Sarah Silverman famously told an audience why she hated sleepaway camp as a kid.
It was terrible for me because I was a chronic bedwetter till I was like 15. So it was a nightmare. I learned a lot of skills, like complete disassociation.
Tig Notaro also went viral for opening a set by revealing a recent diagnosis.
I have cancer. How are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you?
She went on to spell out the concept and make another joke about it.
It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy.
Crafting stand-up sets like these was one goal of Angie Belcher's comedy course. Participant Will Reynolds says another perk of the class was that it didn't carry the same stigma that sometimes surrounds traditional therapy.
There isn't that same stigma because you kind of go, yeah, I am getting therapy, but also I've just done 20 minutes of, like, really decent stand-up.
Reynolds adds the class didn't cure him of his struggles with mental health. No six-week course could. Angie Belcher says it's meant to complement rather than replace other therapies. Still, it was deemed a success. UK charity Rethink is now funding Belcher to teach a course for men at risk of harming themselves in London, and it's set to launch later this year. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Coming up, the head of the African Union asks Putin for food relief, and we remember the hawk. Ronnie Hawkins, a kid from Arkansas who made his name in Canada as a wild rockabilly.
Ronnie was the same person on and off stage. I mean, he wasn't doing somersaults backstage or anything like that, but he was always flamboyant.
Canadian music would never be the same. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Ecuador, the mining industry is critically important to the country's economy. Gold, copper, silver, not to mention oil, are all found in Ecuador's part of the Amazon. Those mining operations also pose a threat to people who live in the region. The World's TBC's Seya spoke with two indigenous activists who've been bringing attention to this and have been named recipients of a prestigious environmental award.
Deep in the Ecuadorian Amazon, close to the border with Colombia, there is a place called Sinangue. It's one of the most biodiverse rainforests in South America. These videos were sent to me by local environmental activists. They are part of the Kofan Nation, an indigenous tribe that's been living there for thousands of years. The river is the main watershed that provides fresh water and transportation routes. But this ancestral land has been severely damaged by decades of mining operations. This is why in 2017 the Kofan created La Guardia Indígena, an indigenous forest patrol. Alexandra Narváez was the first woman to join the group. It uses drones and GPS tracking devices to follow what's happening in the rainforest.
La Guardia somos los encargados de vigilar nuestro territorio. De hacer recorridos, de,
we surveil our territory, she tells me. We walk around and make sure no outsider contaminates our river or hunts animals without our permission. In one of these walks, back in 2017, Narváez and her team discovered a serious threat to their homeland. We flew a drone over an inaccessible area and placed camera traps along remote trails, she says.
Ya máquinas retroexcavadoras ya contaminando nuestro río, talando árboles.
And we saw mining excavators in the river and trucks cutting down trees.
Que nos dio mucha rabia, mucha indignación de ver.
We were very angry, Narváez says, to see these machines doing work there without our consent. It turned out that the Ecuadorian government had signed dozens of deals for large-scale gold mining in the area.
Y nuestro territorio es algo que no se puede vender porque es como vender a tu propia madre.
Alex Lusitante is a traditional healer with the Kofan community. He says their territory is sacred and it's not for sale. It would be like selling your own mother. Lusitante helped organize protests against these newly discovered mining operations. That helped attract support from international environmental groups. Victor Marco is with Amazon Frontlines in Ecuador.
It's not just these big mining companies. Once that infrastructure tears roads, it also encourages smaller miners, illegal poachers, to use those roads to penetrate the lands. And there's no recourse for people trying to stop them. They're not heard.
Marco says the main challenge in Sinangué was to convince indigenous people that change was possible. Alex Lusitante, the healer, says he came to this realization. If Ecuador's government wasn't going to protect his people's land and culture, the indigenous Kofan would do so.
Y he visto como lo cruel que es la ley ordinaria que siempre intenta buscar la manera de explotar y favorecer su no hacia el capitalismo.
I've seen cruelty in the government, Lusitante says. It's always looking for ways to exploit our territory in the name of capitalism. The Kofan people filed a lawsuit against Ecuador's government in 2018. In the meantime, Alexandra Narváez and her forest patrol gathered evidence.
Hemos logrado tener las pruebas para demostrarle al juez y al mundo.
We got photos and video to prove our allegations were real, she says. Their legal battle went on for several years. Ecuador's Supreme Court eventually ruled in their favor. Now, indigenous communities must approve any mining project on their lands. This historic decision closed the door to mining on nearly 80,000 acres of rainforest. Victor Marco says the Kofan people have a lot to celebrate.
To win a constitutional court ruling of this magnitude is one of the most powerful things that can happen, not just for Ecuador, but for indigenous people all around South America. Anybody can come patrol lands, but really to partake in your territory is a part of what makes an indigenous community thrive and live.
For their work on environmental protection, the 2022 Goldman Prize was awarded to Alexandra Narváez and Alex Lusitante. Full of joy, Lusitante grabbed his guitar and composed a song in honor of his homeland. For the world, I am Tibisay Sea.
Today, Vladimir Putin met with the head of the African Union. Macky Sall's message, Africa is worried about food. Russia and Ukraine supply more than 40% of Africa's wheat, and the war has severely disrupted that. Here to discuss all this is Joseph Siegel. He's the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington. So Macky Sall is president of Senegal and currently holds the chairmanship of the African Union. What is he hoping to get out of a meeting with Vladimir Putin, Joe?
Well, I think the immediate concern is to see if Vladimir Putin can release the blockade Russia has held on Ukrainian ports and see if that can free up some of the stored Ukrainian grain that could then make its way to Africa and help not just with the supply, but to reduce prices for food all across the continent.
Right. I mean, food insecurity is a rising concern in Africa. And my understanding is not just about the blockade on the Black Sea. This also involves the SWIFT system. And we got to go back to the early days of sanctions. And the SWIFT banking system was targeted. Explain how that has a counterproductive impact on African countries.
Well, this is a rationale that we've heard from the Russians, that as part of the sanctions against Russia, that the restrictions on the SWIFT system has inhibited Russia's ability to export fertilizer and grains, that it's reducing their shipping. By and large, that doesn't seem to be the main cause for any restriction on supplies that we're seeing. You know, grain is not under the sanctions imposed by the West. You know, the more direct and immediate effect has been the Russian blockade of the Ukrainian ports. If Russia were interested in really helping resolve the food crisis, it would allow those shipments to move forward. So they're using the food issue as a bargaining chip.
Yeah, and yet the head of the African Union, Macky Sall, also said that Western sanctions are creating serious problems for African economies. But is it fair to put some of the blame for the situation in Africa on the West?
I think that's a false equivalence, to be honest. This spike in food prices that we're seeing, the food shortages, have really been precipitated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, that's what's caused this disruption that we've seen. And I think if we're really trying to identify drivers and what can be done, it's about ending the conflict, but immediately ending the blockade of the ports.
How else has the war in Ukraine impacted African countries?
Well, I think the main impact we've seen is politically. Russia has tried to portray the conflict as a competition between the East versus the West. And by framing it as East versus West, it's putting a number of African countries in an awkward place. They don't want to be seen as getting in the middle of a great power competition. So that's why we've seen many African countries abstaining from various UN votes and otherwise trying to be neutral in what's going on.
I mean, it's interesting. Macky Sall is chairman of the African Union. He's also, as I said, president of Senegal, which is notable for its democracy. It's not an authoritarian state. Do you find that ironic?
There is some irony that Senegal hasn't taken a stronger position in condemning Russia's aggression in Ukraine. But you know, there's a mixed bag of motivations from the Africa side. And I think as chairman of the African Union, Macky Sall is trying to represent that broader coalition and not take a strong stance as the head of the AU. And I think from a practical standpoint, there's a very direct benefit that the AU would like to see in terms of the release of grains from Russia and the blockade of Ukraine. And I think that's motivating the tepid response we've heard from Senegal. But I think there's also this concern that AU and African leaders more generally don't want to be seen as crossing Putin. Putin had said in April, actually, that countries that were on its unfriendly list would be penalized in terms of access to different exports of Russian grains and fertilizers. And so there's an incentive to keep your head down and just not draw attention to yourself with what's going on.
And the immediate concern, as you said earlier, Joe, is about food. Looking beyond this meeting, how do you see relations between Russia and African nations evolving?
I think we're going to see a even stronger push from Russia to gain influence in Africa in the coming years. With Russia's isolation, you know, Russia's looking for other places where it can remain active and remain relevant, and basically to demonstrate that it has leeway to move in the international sphere. And Russia provides a very permissive environment for that. The tactics that Russia is using to gain influence, deployment of mercenaries, the use of disinformation, election meddling, these things are welcome by governments that aren't relying on staying in power through popular means. And so I think there's a real self-interest on the part of some African governments for increased Russian involvement moving forward, you know, because it's, you know, Russia's able to gain this influence at relatively limited cost. I think it's very attractive from the Russian standpoint, too, and it certainly serves their geostrategic interest.
I've been speaking with Joseph Siegel about current relations between Russia and the African Union in the midst of the war in Ukraine. Joe's director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Joe, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Cheese rolling is a competitive sport, and it's exactly what it sounds like. Contestants run down a hill chasing a runaway 9-pound wheel of cheese. After 2 years of pandemic hiatus, the contest will return this Sunday to Cooper's Hill near Gloucester, England. Here's what it sounded like in 2017.
All right, we're ready. Watch the cheese.
At the top of the hill, an official releases the cheese. Dozens of contestants, mostly teens from local pubs, because I guess that's where you find people willing to chase wheels of cheese, they launch themselves down the hill in hot pursuit. The 650-foot course is your standard grassy slope with divots and gullies to make the run interesting. Historically, the cheese has been double Gloucester, a traditional full-fat, hard cheese made from cow's milk. After it starts down Cooper's Hill, a wheel of double Gloucester can reach speeds up to 70 miles an hour. Imagine a giant white hockey puck bouncing down the hillside. In 2013, for safety reasons, the cheese was replaced with a foam replica, but that's the only concession to safety. Because speed is of the essence, contestants, known as cheese rollers, dive and tumble down the hill, actually doing full somersaults to gain some advantage. The cheese is always first to reach the bottom of the hill, but the first person to get there wins the prize, an actual wheel of double Gloucester. Everyone else seems to have a good time. This contestant was covered in mud and bruised but beaming, as he told German broadcaster Deutsche Welle that he was probably last to finish the race.
I've come down pretty unscathed, but overall I'm pretty banged up. So once you get going, your mind is completely blank. I don't remember half of it. I just remember at one point I was falling like crazy. I'm still in one piece, and that's all that counts.
This year's cheese rolling will include three races for men and one for women, plus a children's event, which for safety reasons will be a race up the hill. Thanksgiving Day 1977, San Francisco, the last waltz concert, a cinematic farewell for the rock group The Band. Canadian musician Robbie Robertson takes the stage to offer thanks to a musician who mentored the group.
16 years ago when we started with a guy you might have heard of. We'd like to start with him, the Hawk, Ronnie Hawkins.
Ronnie Hawkins, born in Huntsville, Arkansas, but found success and a new life playing the club circuit in Canada starting in the late 50s. Eventually moved there and became a permanent resident in 1964. The impact of Ronnie the Hawk Hawkins on the 60s and 70s music scene in Toronto, across Canada really, it can't be overstated. He was huge. Ronnie Hawkins died on Sunday at the age of 87 in Peterborough, Ontario. Canadian folk singer Sylvia Tyson of Ian and Sylvia fame joins us now from her home in Toronto. What was the influence Ronnie Hawkins had on musicians like yourself, Sylvia?
The entire music scene in Toronto was quite small at that time, and we all hung out together. The folk artists, the jazz artists, and rock and blues artists. So we all knew each other. We all hung out together. Ian and I used to go to Le Coq d'Or, where Ronnie was a fixture, and to see him and his band, the Hawks. And as you know, the Hawks later became the band.
Right. I mean, at the time, Levon Helm and Robbie Robertson were in the band, the Hawks. When did you first meet Ronnie Hawkins, and what was getting to know him like?
It probably would have been in about 1962. And Ian and I were just establishing ourselves in the folk scene in Toronto. And as I say, everybody knew everybody, and that was what you did. You went from club to club.
Ronnie Hawkins wasn't just a rockabilly pioneer, a rock and roll pioneer, and a mentor to many Canadian musicians. He was also known for being pretty flamboyant, a wild kind of guy. Was that all show, or did the rowdiness continue backstage?
Ronnie was the same person on and off stage. I mean, he wasn't doing somersaults on backstage or anything like that, but he was always flamboyant, always had
you know, picturesque phrases from his Southern background, and some of which I daren't repeat. And as everybody knows, he always had a great band. And the reason he always had a great band is he found really good young players and worked them very hard. The minute they finished the show, they would go backstage or downstairs and rehearse there.
He had a strong work ethic, didn't he?
Yes, he certainly did. And he made sure that all the bands towed the line. One of his phrases was the reason why he had all these young guys in the band was that they brought in the girls and the girls brought in more guys.
So, Sylvia Tyson, what memory of the Hawk will you always keep in your back pocket?
Oh, I think it was the fact that he was very generous, and he was always, you know, making sure that people knew about other artists.
So he wasn't just about, you know, Ronnie Hawkins. It sounds like he was also about making other fellow musicians better.
Absolutely. He was, as I say, very generous.
That's Canadian folk singer Sylvia Tyson remembering her mentor and friend, Ronnie Hawkins, who died last Sunday at the age of 87.
He'll be very much missed.
Yes, he will. Sylvia, thank you very much for speaking with us and remembering him.
Thank you.
I walked 47 miles of barbed wire. Use a cobra snake for a necktie. Got a brand new house on the roadside. Made from rattlesnake hide. Got a brand new chimney made on top. Made from a human skull. Come on, Robbie, let's take a little walk, tell me. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Eileen took me by the hands and said, ooh, you Ricky, I understand.
The era of European colonialism in Africa may have ended decades ago. For the former colonies of France, it is sometimes hard to tell. People in places like Mali, Côte d'Ivoire, and Senegal continue to grapple with that legacy of colonial rule. Today, you find continued French influence over politics, language, and monetary policy. The relationship is known as Franc-Afrique, and increasingly, more and more young people in those former French colonies are challenging it. From Senegal's capital, Dakar, Alexa Dvorzin reports on a growing movement.
This is a recorded sales pitch in Wolof, Senegal's main language, for the deep-fried, orange-flavored sweets in Amadou Jara's food cart. They go for the equivalent of 15 cents each. That's his nephew with the tagline, Mama, here they come. Jara barely scrapes out a living with the fresh batter he mixes every morning. He uses a popular app to send daily earnings to his family about 150 miles away.
Chaque jour, je fais ça, du matin au soir. Quand j'ai 5000 francs, je vais envoyer ça.
5000, 5,000 in local currency, is around $8. Jada wheels his cart about 15 miles a day through these sand-filled streets from dawn till dusk. No small feat for a 45-year-old. But he's proud to do this, he says. It gives him courage.
Moi, je suis fier de ça parce que ça me rend courageux.
And courage is what all these street vendors need to compete for customers at Coloban, a frenetic transit hub with stacks of jeans, shirts, shoes, hats, belts, and backpacks for sale. But the money everyone's after is hardly worth anything, because the CFA, the currency introduced in 1945, is still controlled by France. Proponents say its fixed conversion rate helps keep inflation down. But prices have risen steadily for years, and so has frustration among Senegalese like Tcherno Alissi, who heads a construction and moving business.
Le franc CFA, c'est un franc de la colonie.
It's colonial money, he says.
You can't use the CFA outside West and Central Africa. And for the French, it's just paper. They print as much of it as they like, then they unload it here in exchange for our raw materials.
En échange, ils prennent leur matière première.
At the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in Dakar, Senegalese development economist Ndongo Sambasila explains that after World War II, Paris was determined to maintain a so-called sphere of influence in Francophone countries as colonialism began to wane.
The French told them, we are going to give you independence, but without sovereignty over any state domain. For example, public education, foreign trade, currency management, and so on. So that's why this system is colonial.
Sila says no genuine development has been feasible with France holding up to two-thirds of the foreign currency reserves of these former colonies. As for the CFA, newly independent countries that tried to go their own way were punished. What followed was a succession of governments across the region that largely ignored the needs of their own populations.
Most of the leaders that you had from the 70s were considered the puppet of the West or puppet of France.
Gabriel Baglo, a Togolese journalist and consultant based in Senegal, was born 1 year after his country's independence. He recalls a childhood fraught with silent resignation about France's grip on Togo.
Even your father in front of you is afraid to say something because you don't know who will report you. It was just like what you have in the former USSR. So there are issues you cannot discuss. They even teach you that you should be happy you are learning the language of the white man. If you are speaking your mother tongue in class, you even punished. They can even beat you.
Democracy was the word of the day after the end of the Cold War, Baglo says. But with policies largely dictated from Paris, reforms in Francophone Africa didn't go very far.
So all those things have triggered a lot of frustration in the population, especially the young generation, who, with the benefit of digital development, they are aware of everything.
And they're organized. A movement called FRAP, the Front for an Anti-Imperialist Popular and Pan-African Revolution, has branches across Senegal and tens of thousands of followers online. It formed 5 years ago in a drive to stop big French companies from pushing out local businesses while expanding their own presence in the country. FRAP's slogan, France dégage, means France buzz off, as 24-year-old spokesman Gérard Coite explains.
Là où nous avions dit France dégage.
People thought this phrase was a bit harsh at first, he says. But what our forefathers endured under colonialism was far worse. France should simply get its hands off our monetary system. With the introduction of a new currency bogged down by the pandemic and other problems, young Senegalese are turning out in droves to support politicians who back the France Buzz Off campaign.
Nous pensons que ce sont les fils et filles de ce pays-là qui peuvent en tout cas faire émerger le pays.
We believe the sons and daughters of this nation should be the ones to take this country forward, Coita says. It's not up to France, the U.S., or anyone else to do that.
Voilà.
La jeunesse sénégalaise.
It's hard for some French people to understand this desire to shake off what locals call mainmise, the French word for stranglehold.
Pourquoi? Parce que je pense qu'il y a une forme d'incompréhension.
Catherine Vivian and her husband Daniel, retired from advertising, settled in the Senegalese capital nearly 50 years ago.
Ils sont assez intolérants.
They're disappointed by what they see as a lack of tolerance and historical understanding among Senegal's younger generation.
Les relations se sont un petit peu éloignées. Voilà.
We're drifting apart, Catherine says. She finds it sad the ties between France and Francophone Africa are weakening.
Par contre, elle a eu aussi des côtés positifs.
Danielle insists the past wasn't all bad and that Senegal wouldn't be where it is today if it hadn't been colonized.
Et puis avec des dogmes.
To economist Ndongo Sambasila, such views reflect France's relationship with its former colonies, which he calls paternalistic. These countries need partners, he says, not parents. But he stresses that Senegal's resolve has nothing to do with hostility toward the French people.
This is not anti-French sentiment. This is a positive desire for liberation. That's why we have to go beyond propaganda to try to find ways to address the challenges we have. Because in Africa, we have very big challenges. And to overcome those challenges, we need a democratic revolution. That's my feeling. That means a new way of organizing political life.
This song is about the million or so Senegalese who have sought their fortunes abroad and returned to make something of their lives back home. Gone so many years, says singer Suleiman Faye, but all the experience in the world won't change the hardship here. Today's young generation is eager to turn that around.
for the World. This is Alexa Dvorsen in Dakar.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here on Monday. Before we go, this is Marco, here to remind you that from now through June 30th, we're asking listeners to support our work. Thanks to your generosity, our journalism remains independent and accessible to all. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making your gift today at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.